This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm.
I'm not going to undermine the hope of achieving critically important health care reforms for this state by pushing prematurely for single payer when it's not the right time for Vermont.
Those were the words of Governor Peter Shumlin yesterday at a press conference he held at the State House. Stunned supporters and a phalanx of reporters listened as Shumlin explained that he was not moving forward with what had become the signature proposal of his tenure as governor.
You know, obviously, this is a deep disappointment to lots of us.
James Haslam is the executive director of the Vermont Workers Center. He says he had no advance notice that the speech was coming, but others expressed relief. Wynn Smith is the owner of Sugarbush Resort.
You know, a lot of businesses the last few years feel like it's death by a thousand cuts. You know, just lots of little, you know, tax increases, fee increases. So no one thing is mortal, but cumulatively, you know, they can be. But, you know, when I did the calculation, this could have been a big gash. Because even at 8%, my costs would have gone up by 17%, 9%, 32%, at 11%, 61%. That's a huge increase.
Vermonters have been expressing surprise, deep disappointment, huge relief, vindication, all other sorts of emotions since the announcement. And today on the program, we'll explore what the financing plan would have looked like and why it was untenable to the governor. We'll also hear from the administration's chief healthcare reform officer, Lawrence Miller, about what happens next. Getting a lot of opinions from people on our Facebook page and at vpr.net. Mike wrote, "Cowardly. Vermont had a chance to set an example for the country and blew it." Aaron says, "Vermont has already set the example for so many standards in the USA. I say give him a break. Give him a year to figure out how to pay for it." And Kathy joined in, "Vermont does not need to set an example. We need to live and not be taxed to death." All right, joining me now to talk about all of this is Vermont Press Bureau reporter Neil Goswami. Hi, Neil. Nice to have you on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And VPR's Peter Hirschfeld. Peter, nice to have you.
Great to be with you.
So let's go through a little bit about what happened yesterday at the press conference. In his announcement yesterday, the governor had his administration's healthcare financing expert, Michael Costa, explain the numbers.
The uniform payroll tax would have to be 11.5% on all Vermont businesses on their qualifying Vermont payroll. There would be no exceptions. There would be no transition relief for small businesses.
And for individuals?
This would require all Vermonters over 400% of the federal poverty level, essentially a family of four with $100,000 of income or more, to pay 9.5% of their income for health care.
So after Michael Costa spoke, the governor followed up with this statement. Let's hear it.
It was clear to me that the taxes required to replace health care premiums with a publicly financed plan would best serve Vermont are, in a word, enormous. 11.5% payroll for every company and an income tax of up to 9.5% for every Vermonter. And small business owners, as Michael just suggested, would be obligated to pay both, if you think about it for a minute, the payroll tax and the income tax. As you can imagine, I asked the team to go back and find another way, other choices that might work. As Michael just summarized, all the alternatives the team brought to me either failed to meet the key criteria that we set out to fulfill or were equally unaffordable. The bottom line is, as we completed the financing modeling in the last several days, it became clear that the risk of economic shock is too high at this time to offer a plan that I can responsibly support for passage in the legislature.
Pete and Neil, you were both in the room as the governor made his announcement yesterday. What was your reaction and what was the tenor in the room? Neil Goswami?
Well, I think nobody was really surprised when they heard the numbers that the administration was putting forth that he decided not to go forward. 11.5% payroll tax, up to 9.5% personal income tax. Those numbers really were a deal breaker for a governor who pledged all along not to move forward on a plan that was would make Vermonters worse off financially. But you know, as the governor said, in a word, I would say the word was bizarre. The whole scene was just bizarre, with reporters gathered there, the advisory council, the business council, healthcare advocates, nobody really knowing what was to come. But in a sense, not really a shocker once we saw the numbers.
But Pete Hirschfeld, even supporters of the governor, big supporters who were really in favor of the single-payer health care plan, they were surprised. He didn't give them a heads up before the press conference, it sounds like.
I think he knew that this was the kind of news that no matter the assurances of confidentiality that you sought from folks, it's not the kind of thing you can keep under wraps. We've had 4 years of speculation in Vermont about how this single-payer quest is going to culminate. And I don't think anybody knew until the press conference actually began that this might be the moment where this thing actually we see the climax. And we've wondered, what is it going to look like when Peter Shumlin finally shows people how he's going to pay for this plan that he's been promising to certain target audiences for 4 years now. And it took a couple minutes to realize what exactly was happening. I think a lot of us thought this was going to be a announcement of what the benefits package was going to look like in advance of the formal unveiling of that to the Green Mountain Care Board, which had been scheduled for today. But as he talked more and more, you got the sense that, holy cow, he's going to pull the plug on this thing.
I think when the governor walked in, he was doing his usual typical grip and grin with everyone. And there was no indication of the bombshell that he was about to drop in the next several minutes.
You know, he mentioned in that clip that I just played from the press conference yesterday, and I quote here, "As you can imagine, I asked my team to go back and find another way, other choices that would work." Did he give any indication of how long he has known that this was not a feasible plan for Vermont?
Yeah, he says his team finished economic modeling on Friday. They sort of met with him on Monday or Tuesday, and he realized it was not going to go forward at that point. It's a timeline that I think I'm not alone in saying seems entirely implausible to have just figured out on Friday that this was not going to work financially.
The fundamental questions underlying this proposal have always been, how much is single payer going to cost, and how much are we going to pay for it, and how are we going to pay for it? And he suggested that the answer to that first question, how much is it going to cost, didn't really become readily available for until the last week or so, as Neil said. And he said it's only then that they kind of began to realize that federal contributions through the Affordable Care Act were going to be $161 million less than what they had originally thought, that Medicaid funding for this venture was going to be at about $150 million less than they thought, that they wouldn't be able to begin realizing administrative savings on a system-wide level for a number of years into this project, and also that the lagging revenue situation that we have in Vermont was going to create even more, quote, headwinds, as Michael Costa termed it. And there are a lot of people scratching their heads and saying, how is it possible that you guys weren't aware that there were going to be these hundreds of millions of dollars in additional liabilities before last week? And had you known that, some pretty simple calculations would have shown you what sort of impact that was going to have on any payroll or income tax you were going to use to fund this thing. So there will certainly be a lot of research going on in the coming weeks into how it was that this information didn't make its way to them in a more timely fashion.
Well, and whether or not perhaps it did, we've heard from several listeners today weighing in saying they think he knew before the election and held it back from the voters, that he knew what the financing plan would be and continued to ride that to election semi-victory, potential victory, whatever we have coming in January.
But it's important to know, and that's an opinion at this point.
Right.
And You know, the governor was steadfast in saying that, you know, he had a press conference 2 weeks ago where he was all smiles. They unveiled this new animated video that they had done that was intended, as he said, to begin a conversation about the crazy way that we pay for insurance in Vermont right now. It really looked like he was laying the PR groundwork for the unveiling of this plan. He was asked 2 weeks ago, has any of the modeling suggested, inputting various financing scenarios into it, have any of them resulted in a bad economic impact on the state? And he said, no, they haven't. We haven't seen anything to indicate that this isn't going to work out the way we have hypothesized it's going to. So we shall see.
You know, we heard from Michael Costa mentioning that small businesses would also have to pay this payroll tax of 11.5%, and that was a big difficulty. Peter Sterling, who's executive director of the single-payer advocacy group Vermont Leads, had this response.
But I think the real final nail in the coffin was when he said there was simply no way to transition small businesses who currently pay nothing for health care to an 11% payroll tax. I mean, then as dead as a doornail, because that was always, to me, in my mind, the number one biggest problem we would have was how do you get a business owner who's paying zero and get them to that 11%?
Neil Goswami, I mean, that is a pretty big hurdle to get over, this idea that there's no transition for some right. small businesses that perhaps weren't paying for workers' health care costs and so would be going, as Sterling said, from zero mm-hmm. immediately to 11%.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's always been a huge looming question, is how do you get businesses that currently offer no health benefits to their employees, pay nothing in health insurance costs for them, how do you get them to a point of being able to absorb? At the time, we didn't know what the payroll tax would be, but now we know it would have to be at least 11.5%. There's a lot of small businesses, you know, mom and pop shops that wouldn't easily be able to take that hit right away. In transitioning them over a 3-year period, according to the governor, would have cost an additional $500 million to the system, and that's as much as an additional 4 percentage points on the payroll tax. So we're looking at 15.5% at that point on some businesses, and that's just that's not reasonable at all.
So overall, are you feeling like there's a sigh of relief coming from the business community, or is the reaction still pretty mixed?
Yeah, it depends on your political viewpoint, I suppose. The National Federation of Independent Businesses, they're relieved. The Vermont Chamber, they're relieved. I would imagine Businesses for Social Responsibility probably have a different perspective, and other, you know, sort of progressive minded groups are disappointed. So depending on your political viewpoint going into this was probably how your reaction, came out in the end.
And, there were a lot of these businesses who I don't think ever really thought that this was going to happen. Mm-hmm. They felt like they knew deep down that payroll taxes on the order of what would be needed to fund a single-payer program would never make it through the legislature, no matter how many mm-hmm. Democrats held office there. But they said that this conversation itself was really harming the business climate in Vermont, and that anybody thinking about growing or coming here or hiring new employees would be dissuaded from doing so, given the prospect even of having to pay a double-digit payroll tax on whatever new expenses they decided to incur as a business.
We're talking today about the bombshell announcement by Governor Shumlin yesterday to shelve plans for a single-payer health care system in the state. Listeners, you can share your reaction with us. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Scott says, no matter what anyone thinks of single-payer, it is clear that Shumlin lied to us all. That is disappointing. Joe has another take, though. Joe says, I admire the fact that he was able to be honest about it. And Chris says, I think it's the right decision. It costs too much. Shumlin seems to be heeding the message from the last election. Although he should have abided by the statutory and his own self-imposed deadlines and disclosed the financing plans long before the election, I still applaud him for listening to the voters. So you can share your thoughts with us. Go to Vermont Edition's Facebook page or vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. VPR's Peter Hirschfeld and Vermont Press Bureau reporter Neil Goswami are with us today analyzing the details of Governor Shumlin's announcement that he's not going to pursue single-payer health care at this point. If you have a reaction you'd like to share, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Rashad says, it's an early Christmas present. I'm so glad Shumlin turned back on this bridge to nowhere approach to healthcare. I like my Blue Cross Blue Shield Vermont plan, and I want to keep it. Andrea says, it's a bit disappointing. Here's hoping we get universal healthcare nationwide soon. And let's go to Robert, who's calling in from Stowe. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. My question is, who answers for the hundreds of millions of dollars that were wasted on Vermont Health Connect website that still isn't working properly when we had no need for this website in the first place if we're not transitioning to single payer when we could have gone through a federal website and saved all this money?
Robert, thanks for the question. Peter Hirschfeld, what about that? I mean, we had to have an exchange. That's a federal requirement. So we had to have an exchange. But Robert is saying, why wouldn't we just go with the federal website, save the money that we spent trying to create a framework for Vermont that could then be applied when single payer came down the pike, which was the direction we were working towards?
Yeah, well, one of the fundamental reasons that the state decided to go its own way in terms of creating a state exchange was precisely because they wanted to use that infrastructure at some point to transition into a single-payer program. By doing our own exchange, we would be able to draw down hundreds of millions of dollars in federal assistance and build a lot of the sort of IT infrastructure that we would need if we wanted to have a publicly run single-payer healthcare system. Now, administration officials will tell you that this was the right move regardless of whether we were going toward the single-payer program or not. But the perception undoubtedly is going to be that Vermont has incurred a lot of expenses that it wouldn't have had to otherwise had it known that it was not going to one day end up where Peter Shumlin had told folks he was trying to take us.
I think it's important to note also that to do the additional state subsidies, they would have gone forward most likely with a state level exchange in order to add those state level subsidies to Vermont Health Connect plans. So there was the main goal, I think, of transitioning to single payer, but there was the added benefit of being able to add state level subsidies to the federal subsidies that people are getting from ACA health plans.
We got a note from John who says, in principle, the idea of single payer is a good thing. The reality, however, is that we are a small state and there is no way this would work without a huge increase in taxes. To all of you who are disappointed, how enthusiastic would you be with a 9% income tax? And assuming you'd be fine with that, what happens when you lose your job because the company you work for has to cut back due to the 11% payroll tax? And that is something that was cited yesterday, was the potential for especially small businesses who were suddenly faced with this payroll tax to actually have to cut the workforce. But not everybody is pleased by this decision that the governor has made. James Haslam is executive director of the Vermont Workers Center, and he says this wasn't the governor's decision alone to make.
This was not a law that was passed by just Peter Shumlin. This was passed by the results of thousands of people in the state coming together and demanding that we can do better on health care. We can treat it as a human right and a public good, or we can have a system which takes all that money that we're already putting into it and delivers a system that's much better than the one we have right now that's based on care, and we finance it in an equitable way.
So what about this idea that there may still be some support, some enthusiasm, either in the business community or in the legislature to move forward with this? Do you see any of that, Neil Goswami?
Well, you know, the Worker Center and James Haslam may have lost the governor yesterday, but they had already lost folks like John Campbell and Chap Smith, who are already transitioning their view of this session to focus on education reform and school governance reform. There will always be pockets of people, strong supporters of single payer, but it was already looking like it was not going to have a very warm reception in the legislature this year, even if the governor came forward with a plan that he thought was great and was pushing hard for.
And this activist wing of the single payer movement, while doesn't represent a majority, they are not merely disappointed by this announcement. They are angry, mm-hmm. and they feel like they are the victims of a long political con that Peter Shumlin perpetrated on them for the purpose of winning their support in 2010 when he needed every vote he could find to win a hotly contested five-way Democratic gubernatorial primary. They feel like they have abided behavior from Peter Shumlin that they wouldn't have tolerated in any other Democrat worth his salt. But because he was holding out this carrot, because he was saying to them, stick with me and I'm going to take us to the single payer promised land no matter what everybody else is saying, the hurdles are standing in our way. And they believed him. They stood behind him for the most part, and they're out for blood today.
Well, so on that note, what happens now? What are the political implications for Peter Shumlin's career? I mean, you look at his analysis in 7 Days today, and Paul Heinz is saying, quote, now that his political Ponzi scheme has tumbled to the ground, what is left is the shell of a governorship devoid of credibility and purpose. That is pretty damning language.
It certainly is, but you know, it's hard to imagine a scenario where the governor regains enough political clout to really force through, as he likes to say, the tough things, get the tough things done. It's hard to imagine how he gets back that swagger that he was so well known for.
So, what's Scott Milne saying? Anything? Anybody heard anything from Scott Milne yet?
Yeah, I mean, you talk to him and he says, well, you know, throughout the campaign, I told you, I'm single payer is dead. Peter Shumlin's going to wait till after the election. You know, it's sort of a subdued, hey, I told you so from Scott Milne.
Your thoughts, Pete Hirschfeld, on the fallout from this and what happens next?
2016 is a presidential year, and Peter Shumlin is going to benefit from some of the natural dynamics that we're going to see. A lot more Democrats are going to be coming out then than came out in this past election, and most of them will be voting for the person with the D next to their name in the gubernatorial race. But the issue of credibility is going to be a big one, and he has spent 4 years telling people, trust me, believe me, I know I'm not showing you anything about how I'm going to do this, but I need you to have faith in my ability to get this done. And not only did he not get it done, but he didn't even get to the point where he was able to show people a plan for how to get it done. So certainly his work is cut out for him, convincing people to buy into his next big idea.
That's VPR's Peter Hirschfeld. We've also been talking with Vermont Press Bureau reporter Neil Goswami. Pete, Neil, thank you very much for your analysis and thoughts today. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Jane.
Thank you.
We're talking about Governor Peter Shumlin's decision not to move forward with single-payer health care. You can share your reaction by going to Vermont Edition's Facebook page or go to vpr.net. You can post in our discussion forum there. And now we turn to Vermont's Chief of Healthcare Reform, Lawrence Miller. Lawrence Miller, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Hi, Jane.
So when did you know that this announcement was coming and that the plan was not feasible?
We were looking at information, the analysis coming in over the past couple of weeks and revising assumptions, and really only as recently as Friday, bringing to the governor the view as we saw it through the microeconomic analysis lens. He sent us back with some additional work to do over the course of the weekend, and by the end of the weekend, it was becoming clear that the combination of assumptions and hurdles would not put us in a position where we could make a responsible recommendation to go forward with financing at this point.
You've heard from a lot of people, even including our reporters today, saying there are questions out there about why you didn't know sooner that there were going to be some enormous hurdles that you were unlikely to be able to clear.
No, we knew there were enormous hurdles. clearly. They mentioned a number of times that the federal component is certainly one of the highest risks, and that we needed to wait until we had a thorough analysis to make a determination about what recommendation we could make. You know, the early runs looked better than the later runs as we tightened up the model and worked to ensure that we were using responsible assumptions. Many of the pictures that that we saw through the macroeconomic analysis that had been done previously were certainly favorable. There were, you know, it appears to be a reasonable premise that there would be a way to manage those transitions. But I think at this point, the transition risk clearly exceeds the potential benefits.
We got a note from Beth who says, let's work on increasing high-paying jobs in the state, friendly business relations with new and existing companies, and then go back and address health care. And let's go to Vincent, who's calling in from Bethel. Hi, Vincent. You're on the air.
Hello. This is I was just wondering about a while back, we paid a mathematician $300,000 to model single-payer against other systems. And I would have thought that would have told us the cost that we're going to be of this system. And I'm wondering what happened to that information.
The costs of the system didn't change through the microeconomic analysis. The specific question that is being asked by microanalysis is, what is the impact on individuals, and what are individuals and firms likely to do in response to those impacts? It's the next layer of analysis that's necessary.
In other words, it wasn't clear at that point when the comparison study came out.
That's right. And this work will all be published out. We'll be completing the report on this analysis, and it'll include the clear layout of what the assumptions were in Shao, what the assumptions were in the 2013 report, and what the assumptions were as we did this final piece of work.
We're talking about the decision announced yesterday to not pursue single-payer health care at this time. Governor Peter Shumlin announcing that yesterday, that the signature point of his administration was not going forward at this point, and we're getting reaction from around the state today. If you'd like to share your thoughts, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. John says, the real question is, how much money has been spent on this adventure and why? Lawrence Miller, do you have figures?
I don't have figures. There are a number of inquiries today, so that is being compiled and will be released. I think it's important to recognize that the single-payer financing component of healthcare reform is only one piece of the activities that have been undertaken over the last few years. And I think everybody agrees that continuing to operate the system as it has been, and it frankly has not been much of a system, so to speak, is clearly not tenable. There does need to be a continued effort in reform. The work that the Green Mountain Care Board has been doing, the work that Blueprint has been doing, the enhancements to coordination of care among the designated agencies and the medical profession, cost containment, all of these efforts need to continue, because one of the things that challenges all businesses and all individuals are these costs. These costs are growing much faster than the rest of the economy, and it's one of the one of the headwinds that you face when you look at assuming public financing for something that's growing faster than the rest of the economy. There's no revenue source that meets that. So the need to trim the sails to provide better cost containment is important. The other thing that's important is we are continuing to exacerbate the cost shift through underfunding Medicaid. So the state does need to move forward with providing more financial support, which will in turn draw down more federal dollars as well, so that we're not seeing commercial insurance be burdened with that cost shift and have commercial insurance be more expensive for Vermont businesses than it needs to be.
I want to talk more about where we go from here now. We got a note from Seth and Winooski, though, that I'll read first, saying, I'm surprised to find myself feeling relieved at this announcement. Although I have long supported single-payer health care in principle, my wife and I were growing nervous at the prospect of its implementation in Vermont. Although we don't make very much money, we are lucky to be the beneficiaries of an ERISA health plan with generous benefits. As a working family with two small children, any increase in cost or reduction in benefits represents a serious blow to our standard of living. Although we felt guilty for enjoying health care while others do not, under the governor's health care plan, our costs would have skyrocketed. We got a note from Barbara in Huntington who wants to ask a question that's similar to what we heard from earlier from Robert who called in. Barbara says, now that Vermont isn't going to pursue single-payer health care in the near term, will the state look to streamline the Vermont Health Connect system to reduce costs and administration? Lawrence Miller?
The Vermont Health Connect system has very much the same functional requirements. There wasn't anything layered into that project that would be an additional extra for any sort of a single-payer system. The backbone of the Vermont Health Connect system is the eligibility engine, and we really need to have a new Medicaid eligibility system in any event. The vast majority of users of Vermont Health Connect are, in fact, Medicaid eligible users, and then the qualified health plans are also available through that system. We are reducing scope and focusing on completing the elements that are uncompleted. We've got an application in with CMS for the funding to complete that work, and that's in development. But certainly we cannot continue to have Vermont Health Connect operate the way it is. It's got to be completed so that people don't have the same kind of problems that they've been having with the system.
Dr. Deb Richter, who's the chair of Vermont Healthcare for All, a big single-payer advocate, says today that she is still committed to working towards single-payer in this state. Let me play to you what she's saying.
I think we need to have all Vermonters be re-educated of the fact that we are paying the entire healthcare bill right now, and that cost containment is certainly key. We have the Green Mountain Care Board who is working, you know, very hard and has actually saved Vermonters money. So I intend to continue trying to work with them to work on that and just continue the advocacy that I've been doing for the last 26 years.
To put on to what she was just saying, we got a note from Winston who says, when the governor says that now is not the right time, I'm curious as to what is going to change at some future point in time that will make it the right time. Is the cost going to decrease for some reason such that it will be more affordable at some point? Lawrence Miller, looking there at Deb Richter and at Winston, what do you see for the future of healthcare in Vermont and how we pay for it?
Yeah, I think the most important near-term work is in continuing to take the cost containment steps that are underway. And one of the bigger problems, if you look at the models, is that the growth rate for healthcare continues to outpace the rest of the economy. So it takes an increasingly disproportionate share of the economy, whether we pay for that through premiums or pay for it through government expenses, is immaterial. It's still a cost faced by all Vermonters. So we've got a tremendous amount of work ahead of us to provide better cost containment across the state and across the country. I mean, this is not an effort that Vermont is undertaking in isolation. These are issues that face the entire country.
Do you see single payer coming back around? Do you see this as something that we will revisit in the short term?
I don't see it in the short term. I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done in cost containment, in working with our federal partners, in boosting our share of Medicaid, in closing the gaps that people will see in the report. And then at some future time, people may revisit the question of single-payer financing, or the nation will address it.
Well, on that point, on the nation, Nicole is calling in from Guilford. Nicole, we're just about out of time, but I want to let you ask your question because I think it was about the national debate.
Yes. It's clear that anything like this is dead in Vermont. Chamberlain has lost all support he's had from anyone who was behind him in the past. What I'm concerned about is what this will affect in the future. From now on, Vermont will simply be example that the opponents can point to as a failed. Obviously, this isn't going to work. I think Chamberlain has a lot to be ashamed of.
All right, let me leave it there and put that to Lawrence Miller. Does Vermont now set an example for people who say single payer can't work on a national scale?
No, I don't think so. I think we learned a tremendous amount through this exercise that we'll be putting out identifying those gaps that made it untenable at this time. It also identifies the issues that we all need to work on to make it possible in the future.
Lawrence Miller is the chief of healthcare reform for the state of Vermont. He's been clarifying how Governor Shumlin's announcement that he's not going to move forward with single payer will affect Vermont. Thank you very much for taking the time with us today.
Thank you, Jane.
Coming up, Casey Family Programs unveiled a report today detailing changes that need to be made at the Department for Children and Families. We'll go through their recommendations with DCF Commissioner Ken Schatz next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We turn now to another developing news story, changes Vermont needs to make to its child protection system. That has been a big issue following the homicides of two toddlers who were under state supervision. Throughout our ongoing coverage, we've discussed many different reports and investigations into this issue, from a legislative panel to criminal investigations to internal reviews to a damning review by the Citizens Advisory Board. This morning, the state released one more report that had been long awaited, an external review the state commissioned from Casey Family Programs. The top-line findings agree with previous conclusions. The state needs to hire more caseworkers to deal with child abuse allegations and improve its method of assessing whether a child is at risk of harm. The report also puts these issues in context with drug abuse in families. Joining me now to look at the findings and recommendations in the Casey Family Programs report is the Commissioner of the Department for Children and Families, Ken Schatz. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Jess.
The Citizens Advisory Board report that we spoke to you about recently looked at what happened in the two children's deaths that I mentioned, very specifically at their deaths. This report looks at family services generally. Can you just outline quickly what the key findings are in the report?
Well, I think that you fairly accurately summarized them in that they, even though they used different methodology than the Vermont Citizens Advisory Board, that is, they did talk to a lot of people, both inside and outside the system. They came up with conclusions that many social workers do operate under excessive workloads, and that does hinder their ability to do their jobs, that we need to do a better job in terms of early assessment and better access to prevention and treatment services, particularly for families with substance abuse and mental health problems, and that, in addition, we need to provide better training and coaching to our staff who work with families, particularly, again, with respect to families with substance abuse problems.
So better coaching for and better training for people who are working with these families when the families are in a vulnerable situation, more staffing, and the report also says better reporting, better transparency. What does it tell you that all of the various reports that are coming out have found similar themes and have agreement on what is not working in family services?
Well, I think what it does is give us a consistent and clear message about those areas that we need to improve upon. And it is, in some respects, helpful that there is agreement so that we can move forward without any concern about differing opinions regarding those areas that need improvement.
One thing that pretty much every report that has come out has singled out is that DCF is understaffed. When we spoke to you a couple weeks ago, you said that you would hold off on making judgments about staffing levels until the Casey report was ready. So what do you think now about hiring more investigators, more supervisors, more social workers, and other staff?
There is no doubt that we are under-resourced. What we have to figure out is how best to address that that issue and to provide our social workers and our, with more resources so they can be more effective in doing the hard work that we ask them to undertake. One of the interesting things about the Casey Family Programs report is that it does talk about a potential to use paraprofessionals to undertake some of the roles and responsibilities that right now social workers undertake. That is, transportation issues, accompanying people on visits to doctors and other professionals. And so that's an area that we're immediately looking at to see if we can enhance our resources by hiring more paraprofessionals. But again,
let me stop you right there for a second, just because your phone line is a little bit bad. So for people who are struggling to hear what you're saying, you're talking about paraprofessionals, that there may be an area where you can hire paraprofessionals to do some of the work that social workers are currently doing, like providing transportation services for families to get to appointments, perhaps providing some supervision on family visits, so that that could take some of the workload burden off of social workers, and they might have more time to do some of the other work that these reports say they don't have the time to do. Go on. You were continuing, Commissioner.
That is correct. That is part of the KC Family Program's report and recommendation. So we are immediately looking at that to see whether or not we can implement that, and if so, when.
The Citizens Advisory Board co-chair, Dr. Hagan, told us he thought the number of new hires DCF needed was in the realm of 40 people. Are you going to be able to get there?
One of the things that, you know, will be part of the legislative process is looking at these reports and determining what the appropriate level of funding and how many new social workers we can add to our complement.
So tell that to me again more clearly. Does that mean you think you're going to be able to get there or not?
That will be ultimately a legislative decision. I don't know the answer to that.
Are you going to put in a request for funding to get to that level?
We will clearly indicate consistent with these reports that we need more resources and we need more social workers. What the proposal will be at this point, I don't know.
And I understand you're actually adding some new employees as we speak, basically.
That's correct. So it's coming out of the Secretary Chen's report to the governor regarding strengthening the department. We have gotten approval to hire 10 additional positions. The 5 of them are within the Economic Services Division. 2 of them are our assistant attorney generals to particularly help our work with termination of parental rights cases. And 3 others are to assist the Family Services Division in our central office. One of those positions is in St. Albans to assist in that office as an assistant director. Another position is to assist our centralized investigative unit. And the 3rd position is a policy position as part of our recognition that we really do need to review and revise our policies to make sure we're appropriately addressing safety issues. And so we have been authorized to hire a position to revise our policies.
This report from KC Family Programs spends a lot of time discussing the role of opiates and drug addiction in the problems facing our child protection system. Here's a comment that your Deputy Commissioner Cindy Walcott made at this morning's press conference.
Quite frankly, I think the whole state underestimated the impact. I think, to put it simply, I think system-wide we were unprepared.
And she's talking there about the impact of drug abuse on the child welfare system and on families. With all of the attention that we've been placing on opiates and on DCF in the past year, how did no one act on the connection between the two sooner?
I think we have made some initial steps. What I think Cindy Walker is talking about is quite right, that we need to do a lot more. That is, we did retain early on 2 substance abuse professionals through the Lund Center to assist the Family Services Division. As a result of earlier enhancements to our staffing, we added 4 more. And in addition, we are continuing to have consultation with the National Center on Substance Abuse and Child Welfare to improve our practices and protocols. So we have a lot more work to do. I think this issue, though, is more than just DCF. The issue of opioid abuse is something that I think our whole community needs to continue to do more work on, and we're certainly part of that and committed to continuing that effort.
Ken Schatz is the commissioner of the Department for Children and Families. Thank you very much for talking with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I want to let you know that we will be continuing to look at this issue. We'll have more reporting on this on VPR, and you can find it at vpr.net. We're also continuing to look at the fallout from the decision made by Governor Peter Shumlin not to pursue single-payer health care. You'll find all of that at vpr.net and here on the air. Tomorrow on this program, we are going to take a break from hard news. I think everybody could use a little bit of lightheartedness. We are going to have our annual music show. We'll be listening to the songs that remind you of the past year and sharing stories and music throughout the hour. So please do join us for that tomorrow at noon and at 7. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Isla Yersel. Peter Biello directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.